I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. During World War I, an estimated 10 million letters were exchanged between American servicemen and their families. They told stories of love, loss, and yearning. Today, we dive into the life and the 223 letters of Sergeant George Wigert, a Nebraska native who served in France during the Great War. Then, it's a tense time for diplomatic relations between Mexico and the U.S. President Trump wants to build a wall, NAFTA's status is in the air, and our southern neighbors been blamed for everything from a crime wave to a drug epidemic. We'll ask Mexico's top diplomat in Washington how he's handling the Trump age. Later, the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Pat O'Neill, Kansas City's well-known marketer, is out with a new book that chronicles the 223 letters that a small-town kid from Nebraska sent home to his mother during World War I. Turns out that about 10 million letters were sent between soldiers and their families during the Great War. The young man was Sergeant George Wigert, and the book is titled Dearest Mother, Letters from a Lonesome Sammy, 1915 to 1919. Pat O'Neill is also the author of From the Bottom Up, The Story of the Irish in Kansas City. Pat is the founder of O'Neill Marketing and Event Management. And Pat, it's always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to be here.
This book is titled Dearest Mother, Letters from a Lonesome Sammy. What's a Sammy?
Sammy is what a lot of the French referred to the soldiers, the American soldiers coming, as Uncle Sam's Army. So they were Sammies. And he prided himself in being a Sammy.
How did you latch onto this idea of these letters home from young George Wigert?
Well, you know, my grandfather always took us down to the Liberty Memorial, the old little museum that was in the back, and he would talk to me a little bit, especially me being the oldest of seven brothers, and he'd take me down there and he'd tell little stories, no harmless kind of stories about right. The war. And he passed away in 1976, and I have to start it by saying, 3 years ago, first of all, I want to say this week would have been his birthday, October 23rd. It was also the day the Americans fired their first shot at the Germans, and he was there on his birthday.
No kidding.
But 3 years ago, when our mom was in home hospice and just not too far from here over in an apartment, my brothers and I would spend the night with her. We'd take turns, the seven of us, and One night we were fiddling around after she went to bed, and my brother Steve comes up with these like boxes of letters, and I thought, I've never seen those before. And we started going through them. I go, these are great. They start when he was in military school as a 15-year-old.
George Wigert, you're talking
George
about.
George Wigert, mm-hmm. And his letters to his mother in Lincoln, Nebraska, and then through the war, and then in the Army of Occupation for 8 months after the war.
Why did the O'Neill family have these letters from this kid who lived in Nebraska?
Well, because my grandfather, George, grew up in Nebraska, moved to Kansas City during World War II, and worked for the city. I think he was one of those famous guys that had what do they call them, pads, the payroll. He'd back in the 50s and 40s, but at any rate, he moved here, and so he had saved his mother had saved all those letters, and she had later come to live with him before she died in Kansas City, to Kansas City. So he had these letters. It's funny, I thought I'd never seen these letters before, but then I realized, saw a few of them, that the stamps were missing. I remember being a stamp collector when I was 11 years old. I must have gone through them and, ripped the stamps off. But, it's what's real poignant about these letters is, you think of your grandfather or people like that, they have an image of them. And the image is like my grandfather was wore a white shirt and a bow tie and smoked a Salem cigarette every day. I mean, he dressed for breakfast, but I didn't really know him very well. And then when you read these letters, you realize, yeah, he was a kid once. He was a young kid who was full of piss and vinegar.
So just to be clear,
ready to go.
George Wigert was your grandfather.
George Wigert was my grandfather.
That's what I'm missing here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Let's make that clear. But so I know him as one thing. And then I started reading these letters. I transcribed like 200 and some letters, 78,000 words, I think it was. And I, suddenly this vision of a young guy who's like, at the outset of World War One is all full of piss and vinegar, ready to go to France, but he's scared. He's a mama's boy. He's an only child.
Right.
His father had died a few years before, which is why she had sent him to military school. So he's kind of trained in the military, and he wants to be an officer, and he wants to the glory of war until he gets there.
Yeah, that's what struck me about this book, and you just sort of hit on it here. If you look at the pictures, the photographs in the book, a lot of them are these black and white shots. And when folks of our generation see photos like that, the people look like they're just sort of not real.
Yeah, they don't have depth or personality.
But the letters do something different. They bring George, your grandfather, alive in a way that the photographs don't. And that's interesting to
me. That's right. A lot of those photographs and things are out of the scrapbook that he kept. But you're right. I mean, today when we communicate by email and everything's kind of short and get to the point, those letters were intimate, and they were like, you never expected anyone else to ever read them except his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And when he left the station, when Woodrow Wilson, President Wilson, declared war on Germany, and the Congress did in April 6, 1917,
right.
My grandfather was a senior at Creighton, in the high school department at Creighton in
Omaha.
In Omaha.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, so within a few weeks, he dropped out, became one of the really very few volunteers in World War One. When you think of ultimately more than 4 million people in the United States, young men served in the military during World War One. Most were drafted. He was one of the few, maybe 300,000, that actually volunteered. So he was one of the first over. But the poignancy begins when he gets on the train in Lincoln and he's on his way. He goes to Denver, to Fort Logan. And in Fort Logan, they check him in. He's a 19-year-old with 140 pounds, 5'10", corns on his feet, and swore he never wet the bed, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. then he's off to Fort Bliss in Texas, and he's on the train, and he writes his first letter back to his mother, and I'll read a little piece of it if I can. And it says, "Dearest Mother, every once in a while I open my little picture case to look at your sweet face, mm-hmm. and I know that I'll come back because I'm determined to. No mother should love a son who is afraid to do everything in the time of emergency because he isn't worth it if he's a coward. So there's no need for either one of us to feel bad, because if I have to fight, it's because the Lord willed it so, and all is for the best."
Mm.
And that's how it
starts. Says it pretty well, doesn't it?
He does, and he goes down to Fort Bliss and gets his first taste of Blackjack Pershing, and the trainees, and he's out in the desert and the mesquite and the greasewood and rattlesnakes and scorpions and it's dusty, the doughboys.
Isn't there a scene was it Pershing who comes to inspect the troops and George writes back and says, yeah, the commander really dressed down the guy next to him for having dirty shoes. He could have done the same for me, but I escaped without getting a tongue lash.
But he said, he regretted it because I would like to have been dressed down by the biggest man in the army.
It would have been something, yeah.
And for some lint on his uniform.
How do you think your grandfather would feel about these somewhat intimate letters being published today?
I don't know. He was a pretty quiet guy, but he had a sense of humor, and you'll see that through these letters,
Yes.
And with the censors, he used his sense of humor to get by his mother's concerns. I'm like a baby. I'm safe as a baby in his mother's arms. Don't worry about me. He goes, it's pretty quiet now. There's not more than, 100 shells a second or a minute. But of course, sometimes you miscount. He did have a sense of humor. In fact, I want to read another letter because it just kind of chronicles this whole trip. And I pared these down, took all the girlfriend stuff out, mostly because he was trying to juggle three girlfriends.
There were a lot of girls with your grandpa.
Three of them throughout the war. Mm-hmm. And as he gets to, first of all, he gets to, on the train finally, he's from Texas to Hoboken where they're going to embark for France. And this is early, and this is in early June.
Mm-hmm.
Or by the time he get there is almost July or into July, but as their train is coming through like near Buffalo, New York, they discover a bomb on the tracks. Mm-hmm. His train had gone over a bomb. He says, "Mother, we sure came close to getting ours. About 25 miles back, someone placed enough explosives under the tracks to blow this train and the next one to the place beyond the clouds. But the arrangement didn't work, so we passed over to OK, and a track walker saw it before the next bunch came along."
Wow.
These were German saboteurs, and there was
right.
a lot of that going on. They were planting those little cigar bombs on the transport ships out in the harbor in Hoboken. 25% of the population of Hoboken, New York, where all the troops were leaving from, were German-born.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were sympathizers in there. And then he gets on the ship, and every day they're trained how to jump off the ship if a torpedo hits if one of the U-boats comes. But he says, now, Mother.
As if that's going to save him.
Yeah. He said, now, Mother, don't you need to worry about me going over, because there'll be a big convoy and a bunch of transports all together. So if they do sink one, I can swim over to the next one.
Wow. He's really looking out for his mom here.
Yeah, he really is, yeah.
Over and over again.
Throughout the whole book, yeah.
Pat O'Neill's my guest. He'll be speaking and discussing his new book, Dearest Mother, Letters from a Lonesome Sammy, 1915 to 1919. That'll happen at 6:30 this evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, go to kclibrary.org. What do you think, Pat, that we learned about the war and this country's involvement in it through the letters of George Wigert?
You know, I think, well, the war is so different now. You know, it's ironic because, you know, George goes down to Texas and he trains on horses and with pistols.
Yes.
And meanwhile, there's a war going on across the ocean where tens of thousands of people are getting killed in one day because we're not using horses anymore. There's the machine guns and tanks and mustard gas and all these horrible things. But these guys are being trained like it's post-Civil War.
Is he aware of that as he goes over there? Does he know what he's getting into?
You don't
get that sense when I go through.
They read the papers every day. But I think the lesson here is, you know, how a country can get all wrapped up in patriotism and taking umbrage at another country, and just all of a sudden this want to go to war swells.
Yeah.
And then the reality of it hits.
Yes.
And I think that's the reminder, is there's a harsh and huge and horrible reality on the other end of a declaration of war.
When did George's father die?
My grandfather George was 14 or 15 when his father died.
Because in this book, he's out of the picture completely.
He's out of the picture, and his mother couldn't really handle him. He wasn't a bad kid, but apparently he was just, you know, he...
He was a handful, his mother says is the word here. I mean, what kind of kid was he? Because he talks a lot about, you know, he lived out in Axtell, Nebraska when he was first born.
Yeah.
Where is Axtell, Nebraska?
It's the windmill capital of Nebraska. You know that?
I didn't know that. Yeah. Yeah.
No, but
have you been there?
I've been through it. Yeah. And it's really not much there. But his grandfather, his father, who was from Sweden and had been a druggist in Burlington, Iowa. And he married a much younger woman and had this one child, and my grandfather. And he got out there and he homesteaded a piece, you know, with a soddy on it plus a house. But he couldn't handle it. It wasn't like the weather was not like in Sweden. It was, you know, harsh and dry.
So he took his family into Lincoln then.
So he moved into Lincoln to bring some, you know, some comforts and culture to the family. And my grandfather was never a great student, but he was a 19-year-old when he dropped out of high school to join the army in May of 1917. The reason being is he had spent a year in Sweden with his grandmother when he was like 12. So he didn't.
Right.
So he skipped a year of school. But later on, you know, the irony is he wanted to go to West Point, and he had applied for West Point, and the congressman in Nebraska appointed him to West Point when he was on his way to the first battle in France, so it was too late for him to go. So he did ultimately become a sergeant on the battlefield, and he saw, you know, he saw a lot and was on the front quite a bit. Can I read another
one? Yeah, I was going to say, please read another one. They're so poignant.
And this is, you know, again, it was on his 20th birthday when he was in the Somerville sector near Nancy when the Americans fired their first shots at the Germans, and he was there. And a month later, he tells his mother, because the censors are, you know, pretty sensitive about you saying where you were at any given time. He says, "My mother, dear, I know you'll read from time to time articles in the newspapers, and you will no doubt say, I wonder if George is among them. But just don't you worry about me, because I'm all right, and no doubt lies in the fact that I'm coming back. Anyone that uses the word if when he speaks of going home is foolish. So far, this war hasn't got me scared one little bit, but it is sort of a shame when fellas get killed. But that isn't me. I'm never going to die. I know that. And, well, my birthday passed all right. It was spent in a place I never thought of spending a birthday in, and I would like to tell you all about it, but I can't. But I hope I will not spend another in the same way, because I hope that by then there will be no such thing as trenches."
So trench warfare, which was the hallmark of World War I, George Wigert is very much engaged with that.
Yeah, even though he was a gunner, and he told his mother when he left, a gunner's the only 1 out of 10 gunner gets killed, so I'll be fine. But later on, he decides he's getting bored in the trenches, and he wants to sign up for the aviation corps.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells his mother, he goes, it's not near as bad as it sounds. He goes, only 1 out of 10 gets killed. The rest just get wounded.
So comforting.
Yes.
You know, again, I think it's hard to imagine the extent to which, you know, moms and then George himself sort of hung on these letters going back and forth, how much they depended on these things during this wrenchingly emotional time as a world war can be on a mom, much less a soldier.
Well, right. And, you know, he'd write every day, and when he was in training and then in camps, and they'd spend a lot of time, you know, back in a rest camp. He was wounded a couple of times. He took gas at Mont Didier. He also was had a shell wound in his back, and so he'd write every day. And then he'd go weeks maybe without writing a letter because you were on the front and there was simply no way you could. So mothers, you know, mothers lived in fear every day, and especially because there was this long gap in communications. Not like today, you know, if your son was wounded or killed, you'd know it probably that day or the next day.
Right.
It might be months before you realize your son was killed last month, you know. And so I think they hung on pins and needles. Mothers did. Of course they did.
You know, I'm always struck, and I've told this story on the air before, you know, this is World War II now, but out in Abilene, as you tour the Eisenhower Museum, if you go to the boyhood home of Dwight Eisenhower, in the living room, I think it is, or at least it was when I went once, there's an old radio sitting there. And I just used to think of, you know, Eisenhower's mother sitting out on the prairie of Kansas in the midst of World War II, you know, hanging on those radio dispatches from the front to let her know how the Allied forces were doing and what her son's exploits were. You know, she at that point in life sitting all by herself in that old farmhouse out in Abilene, and the radio being the thing that had supplanted letters in your case.
And the other thing was, and he tells his mother, you're the bravest, most wonderful mother that ever lived, because she was, like almost all women and mothers and grandmothers, was involved in the Red Cross. And so especially out in those rural areas, Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, you know, the women got together frequently. Part of it was an ad hoc support group.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they, you know, they would make socks and scarves and bandages, and they, you know, by the thousands, and they'd be shipped overseas. And that was kind of made them feel part of what their son was involved in. And also, you know, it also, like you said, provided a support group.
Okay. You know, once he enlisted, I was really struck by how often he moved around the country, even before he went overseas. Where did he go, Pat?
In this country?
Yeah.
Well, no, he didn't. He just went from Fort Bliss, and then they took the long train ride to Hoboken.
And that was a long train ride.
It was a week or more. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, when encountered saboteurs. He talks about the patriotism would grew as he got closer to the East Coast. And he said our trains would come in, and the people would wave, the factories would blow their whistles, the trains would highball past them blowing their whistles. Because out west, you remember, you know, especially he comes from Lincoln, Nebraska. It's a university town.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the university professors are of German heritage. Many of the people in the city, the merchants, are of German heritage, and they're painting yellow crosses on their houses. They could no longer say their church services in German, in the language. They were so they were really outcast. And there were professors at the university that were sanctioned or censured for their not being patriotic enough, and he writes about that, and he says all the traitors and people he just come home and hang them.
Do you have a favorite letter in here?
There
one that really stands out?
Let me see. I just mainly when he's there. Let me try this one. And dear mother, this is in April of 1918, and things are really, really heating up. You know, there was like 120,000 casualties in Americans in World War One, and I want to say 2/3 of them happened in the last 3 months of the war. So this is just beginning to escalate toward the end of the war. And just think how happy we will be when we can be together once more. I won't have to be carrying around a couple of gas masks and a tin derby on my boat head, in other words. Yes, I've had some close ones, but 15 feet when a shell don't explode is as good as a mile. This big battle that speaks so loudly, both in the newspapers and where I am, in hopes we will finish the Boche, because we sure have killed a bunch of the buggers, all right, and that isn't the half of it. The Tommies are sure scrappers, the English he's talking about, and one Boche colonel called the Americans the jaws of hell. I suppose by the time you get this letter, the big battle will be over. At least I hope it will be over. And the Boche will be sorry they ever heard the word offensive, because it seems to be the greatest battle in history and doubtless most terrible. I do have a favorite. His mother's always asking, what are you doing over there, George?
Yes,
what?
She's dying for information.
And he goes, mother, you don't know a thing about it. You know, I'm a gunner, but when there's all other jobs to do, you do whatever they tell you. And one of them, he said he served a little bit of time as a radio operator. And you'll get a kick out of this coming from a jazz town. He says, mother, on the line you're supposed to talk in code when you're on the radio, and you forget it and slang is used instead. So the Heinies can't savvy our lingo and get hip to our gag.
There you go. That's pretty good lingo. What was his reunion like with his mother when he finally got home?
You know, there's another lesson in that, too. You know, whether your father, your uncles, whatever, people who have served, your sister, whoever served in the military, you form these great bonds with people that you're under, great stress and pressure and fear. And you talk, there's idle hours. There's so many idle hours. You know, we talk about these battles, but there'll be days and days and days where you don't do anything except scrub your rifle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And write letters. And you become so close and so intimate, and yet you promise after the war that you're going to get together, you're going to celebrate our birthdays together instead of in this trench with, a couple pilfered eggs. We're going to have a big, big feast and a smorgasbord in New York. And you tell your mother you're going to come home to her, no more girls for you. You said, don't worry about French girls. I don't have no interest in them.
Yeah.
I'm coming home to just one girl. That's my mother.
Yeah.
And what happens is you come home, you get some letters from your friends who promise to get together, and you don't. You come home to your mother, and after about a week, you get kind of bored. And next thing I know, my grandfather's off to New York to look for a job, and instead he hops a freighter and goes to South America for about almost a year and tramped around there.
Yeah. Are there places online where people can go to read some of these letters?
I have a website that's under my international conglomerate publishing company called seatofthepantspublishing.com.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about the books you've already written, Pat, because this is what number is this for you?
Well, there's two versions of the Irish book I did, the Irish mm-hmm. in Kansas City. I did a new version just not too long ago, hardback, and and added a bunch of, photos and stories to it. Then this one, and I did one on the history of Redemptorist Church. And I have one that I'm working on now about a baseball huckster. He was one of the manager of the Kansas City Cowboys in the 1880s, and he went on to become really the founder of the baseball farm system, and just a consummate hyperbolist. And he's just funny. He's just a real character. He's born in Ireland and raised in Milwaukee, and he was a real, real close pal. Went to school in St. Mary's, Kansas, in the 1870s with another ball player named Charlie Comiskey, and they were lifelong friends.
Okay, Comiskey Field in Chicago.
Right.
Yeah.
Got his first job.
Where do you come up with this stuff?
I'm like you. I just read a lot of things, and something will pop out at you that seems like, that deserves a little more of a story. That deserves a little more research.
And that's what you want to do.
Yeah. I mean, Tom Kaufman, my buddy, and I have been researching his baseball book. He went down to Paris, Texas to research my subject, Ted Sullivan's involvement with the Paris Parasites baseball team back in the day.
Really?
It really was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what else do you see doing next? So after that, what are you doing?
Every family has a story. In fact, your GM was talking about letters that his grandfather wrote to his grandmother after she passed away. Every night he'd write her a letter. Every family has a story. So I want to tell our family story, in Kansas City goes way, way back to what your employer once called a proven scoundrel.
Mm-hmm.
And their competitors called my grandfather, great grandfather, a worse than a bout of Asiatic cholera for the voters of Kansas City. So I want to write that O'Neill story.
Hey, how's your family reacting to this book? Again, given the fact your grandfather was a private man and here all his letters are out there.
Well, I think they're my brothers, my six brothers and I are, just all best friends, and we get together a lot. And in fact, I'm going to walk through this presentation with them because they all walked out on me today. They're going golfing down in Arkansas, so I have to meet them tomorrow, and I'll take it with me. But like we talked about earlier, it's fascinating to learn who that man really was, you know,
yeah.
and that they had a life. You know, he was a youth once, and he was a middle-aged guy in the Depression, you know, fighting off a loss of a job, and then ultimately, you know, coming to Kansas City and being a building inspector. I think the family is glad that this all came out, and they think of him differently now.
Pat O'Neill's new book, Dearest Mother, Letters from a Lonesome Sammy. He speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, visit kclibrary.org. Pat, it's always great to have you here. Good luck with the book.
Steve, thank you so much.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with Mexico's ambassador to the U.S. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we were live at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. We found out how African art transformed the work of Pablo Picasso. And we learned about a new acquisition at the museum, the Gates of Paradise. You can find that conversation at kcur.org. Tomorrow, the title of the new Missouri Almanac might suggest it's a resource to help farmers, but it's not what it sounds like. We'll talk to the authors of this colorful children's guidebook to the Show Me State. Well, depending on how you look at it, Geronimo Gutierrez had the good fortune or the misfortune to be named Mexico's ambassador to the U.S. in January. That, of course, was the same month that Donald Trump became president. To call that position a sensitive one would be putting it mildly. The issues the ambassador is seeking to navigate only include the intensely controversial border wall and who will pay for it, the future of NAFTA, DACA, drug cartels, and immigration enforcement in the U.S. And by the way, Mexico's Missouri's second largest export market, and Mexico is Kansas' largest export market. Billions of dollars flow back and forth across the border each year from our two states. How's all this playing out? We're about to find out as the ambassador has joined us here in the studio. Ambassador Gutierrez, so nice to have you here. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here with you, Steve, and with the audience, and it's always good to be in Kansas City.
You know, I'm wondering why you're in Kansas City and St. Louis, for that matter, this week. What's the point of your trip?
Well, you know, two things. First, I want to persuade people that a strong and successful Mexico is very much in the interest of the United States, as much as a strong and successful United States in the interest of Mexico. And the second thing is, as you know, we are looking at, we're presently engaged in trade negotiations with our Canadian friends, U.S. and Mexico. And it's a good time to be thoughtful about the North American Free Trade Agreement. We believe that it has been beneficial to the three parties, certainly to the state of Missouri. And it's time to raise voices and speak about the free trade agreement.
Now, you said, I was in the editorial board meeting this morning at the Star, where you were before you came over here, and you talked about the fact that relations between Mexico and the U.S. are at a pivot point, a very sensitive point. Why is that?
I would say they're not only a pivot, I would say even a little bit farther, they're a critical point, because over the last 25 years, we have had a very good trend line in the U.S.-Mexico relationship. That does not mean that we see eyeball to eyeball on everything. We do have differences, but by and large, we have been able to solve them. And this is the first time that we are in we confront ourselves with a strong disagreement as partners. Mm-hmm. And I think that we do have the possibility of having a much more mature relationship that works for both sides at hand. But also we do have to face the possibility that there will be a major setback in the bilateral relationship.
Yeah, I want to talk about NAFTA and the ongoing relations, but I also want to talk about the border wall and how Mexico is reacting to ongoing conversations about that and the potential that that wall is going to be built and that Mexico will pay for it. Where does that stand?
Well, first of all, Mexico is not going to pay for the wall. Secondly, we do not question the right, obviously, of the President of the United States to protect it, the borders. We are actually in favor of having secure borders. We just don't believe that's the right way to go. We don't think it's a very good idea.
Why not?
Because there are other ways to tackle the shared security concerns that we have at the border. And on a daily basis, in fact, security agencies from the United States, federal government, from Mexico, exchange intelligence, conduct coordinated operations, and we're very much side by side working to address things that are important, like transnational organized crime or other type of security issues. And we believe that's the best way to approach it.
But wouldn't a wall stop illegal immigration cold, as the president has suggested?
Well, the central point about immigration is the following. We have to recognize on our side that a lot of the people that have come to the United States from Mexico during the many years did so because they did not find opportunity or very good opportunities in Mexico. That's not the responsibility nor the fault of the United States. But we have done our homework, and we will continue to do our homework. And the numbers of immigration from Mexico into the United States are not only way down, they're actually negative nowadays. More people, more Mexicans are returning to Mexico than coming into the United States. Huh. So that's important to take into account.
And why is that happening?
Well, for many reasons, or some reasons. Obviously, one, as I was mentioning, is that Mexicans are finding far better conditions to stay in Mexico. The other thing is that also there's demographics. As the U.S. and Mexico have a complementary demographics, the average age or the median age in the U.S. is 38 years, 27 in Mexico, but that will begin to change very quickly. Mm-hmm. And also there's deterrence, the fact that people see increased enforcement, and that we understand that has changed the numbers drastically.
Mexico's ambassador to the U.S. is my guest. His name, Geronimo Gutierrez. In your view, has President Trump softened his rhetoric now that he's been in office for a few months? Because you've said that relations are improving during your time.
Well, what I said is that at the beginning of the year, we were somewhat worse shape than we are right now in the terms of the relationship, because we were not communicating frequently with one another, and we had not established at different levels of government contacts to try to bridge our differences. We have that now in place. It's not our differences are known, they're public, but we are, I think, honestly on both sides trying to solve them. And that is not insignificant.
Let's look at relations between the two countries, Mr. Ambassador, through the lens of Mexico and the internal struggles your country faces, as all countries do. Just 2 days ago, Duncan Wood, director of the Wilson Center's Mexico Institute, wrote this in Forbes magazine. Maybe the mere suggestion, he said, that the U.S. is an unreliable partner will be enough to scare Mexico into getting its house in order. Maybe politicians will identify the threat and take the necessary steps to remedy some of these problems. Or maybe it will take a collapse of bilateral cooperation to force their hand. If they do what is required, Mexico will emerge from this trying period as a stronger, more lawful, and independent nation. If not, the country will be condemned to decades more of violence, disappointing growth, and dependence on its northern neighbor. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I know Duncan, and I very much respect him and appreciate mm-hmm. him, but I would differ at least in some regards. Mexico does not need anybody to do its homework. It is our own interest, and certainly President Peña Nieto and his government are trying to do everything we can to improve conditions there. And in fact, they have improved. That does not mean that we have a lot of challenges. We do, mm-hmm. and we're facing them.
Right.
The second thing is, the most important part is, the relationship with the United States, it's important because it is very much part of our own competitiveness in a global world. It's not so much about how much we trade between ourselves, although that's important, but it's how we're producing together in order to export for other regions of the world. So the trade relationship for Mexico with the United States is very important. It's our most important relationship. Mm-hmm. And we believe that it's important to have a good relationship. But that, and I guess that's what Duncan is trying to imply, is mm-hmm. that cannot happen at any cost or under any circumstance. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly the position of the Mexican government.
You know, to what extent, I'm wondering, does your country have a PR problem when it comes to relations with this country? I mean, a lot of Americans don't think good things when they think about Mexico, and certainly your visit here today is in part response to that. What about the public relations image of your country?
Well, I think, yes, you're absolutely right, Steve. We do have an image problem that we're trying to face as fast as possible. Mexico, let me try to put it on three fronts. First, people here in the States get a lot of news about security conditions in Mexico or you know, drug trafficking. Those are challenges that we are facing. We're facing them, in fact, with the United States, because it's really about having a market for those things. And what I would say is we need to explain that Mexico is up and running, that the challenges that we do face and confront, for example, with drug cartels, are a top priority of the Mexican government, and we take them very seriously. But at the same time, you will see a country that has great potential, whether it's on tourism. We just recently reformed our energy sector in a way that we can become much more competitive. We had free trade agreements with over 40 countries. So there are a lot of people that see Mexico. We have a growing middle class of now. Mexico has 127 million people, more or less, of population, and a growing middle class that it's buying things from the United States. We buy, for example, from Missouri on a yearly basis over $1 billion of agricultural products that are extremely important for us, but also for the people here in Missouri.
Let's go to the trade issue for a minute, because, again, you talked about it this morning at the Star. One of the big concerns the president has is this trade deficit with Mexico that he wants to rectify. You suggested that maybe that shouldn't be the top priority here when it comes to the ongoing negotiations over NAFTA. How come?
Because the trade deficit is not a good measure to assess the success of a trade agreement. And you know, you don't have to believe me on that. There are many intelligent people in the States that will argue exactly the same. Nevertheless, we know that's a priority for the administration. And what we have said is, you know, if that's something that the United States and President Trump cares for, let's look at ways in which we can address the deficit, but in a way that two or three things occur. First, that we do it not by reducing our trade, but by increasing our trade, looking at ways in which Mexico can buy even more from the United States, where, in fact, Mexico is a huge market for the United States. Mm-hmm. We buy more than all, you know, several European countries put together. We buy more than the BRIC countries, meaning China, India, Russia, and Brazil put together. So we are already buying a lot, but we can certainly look at ways in which we can have more regional component and we can buy more from the United States. But a deal needs to work for everybody in order to be a deal. So it cannot just be about, you know, what's a concern to one side.
Mr. Ambassador, as our time grows short here, how confident are you that NAFTA is going to survive? How do you see this today? People out here in the heartland where agriculture is so important are wondering, how do you see it?
Well, I think that it's, to be honest, I think there's pretty much a toss-up of in the air. I think that there are
a toss-up. That doesn't sound too encouraging.
No, it's not too encouraging. I would say that the possibility that NAFTA will be the scar that exists. And even though there are good people on both sides of the border trying to have avoid that and try to NAFTA can be updated, it can be improved, it can be improved in a way that there's more and better jobs in the United States and Mexico, including those in the manufacturing sector. But the consequences of discarding it would be just very bad, in my view, from Mexico, certainly, but also to the United States. The important thing, and that's what I mentioned, it's time to raise the voices.
Okay. Mr. Ambassador, what a pleasure to have you here in Kansas City. I hope you have a great time. Know how much I appreciate you taking time with us here today.
It's my pleasure to be here, Steve. I thank you for the time, and I hope to return to Kansas. Kansas City very soon.
That's Geronimo Gutierrez again, the ambassador, Mexico's ambassador to the United States. Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Brian McTavish is here to talk about some cool stuff to do on your weekend, and that's Katy Perry.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Now, I like that song.
I do, too.
That's called Chained to the Rhythm.
How can you not like that song?
Well, but do you recognize it?
No.
No. And that might be why there are, as far as I can tell, plenty of seats.
Really?
Remaining.
I thought she was bigger than that.
She is. She's Katy
so
Perry.
So what's happening?
Well,
here?
The latest album, while highly competent in terms of its skillful production, does not have a true anthem. It doesn't have a song like...
This is not off the latest album.
It is.
It sounds
very
like
good.
An anthem.
Well, it does. There's that razor thin line between anthem and anthem-like.
Oh, okay.
And, well, think of songs like Roar, Firework, I Kissed a Girl, Last Friday Night, TGIF, Teenage Dream, totally spectacularly anthemic ditties. This new record, which is called Witness, the album, may not contain one, but you know what? Let's put that aside. Let's focus on the reason we're talking about Katy. 7:30 p.m. show, Friday night, Sprint Center. When it comes to Katy Perry, it's all about the live production numbers. It's all about the
costume changes.
5 or 6 or 9 costume changes, and she's got plenty of them, whether she's floating through the air or she's playing around with crazy oversized props.
Wow.
She's the gal to do it. I love her.
I wonder how they do their costume changes so quickly, because it is breathtaking how fast
they do it. Well, I think for the record, she has 5 or 6 costume changes, and a reviewer of a recent show clocked it at 15 total minutes that she's off stage over the course of an hour, 45, 2 hours.
It doesn't happen that fast.
Well, it bleeds out through the show. But
right.
She's fantastic. I love Katy. Great singer. Great performer. And I just might trundle in there Friday night.
What do we have here? I'm confused. I don't know where we're going.
Well, it's not a kazoo. Actually, this is in honor of Chainsaw the Musical, and that just happens to be a little bit of sound.
Like Chainsaw Massacre that we're talking about?
Well, it's inspired by the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but just for all you hard rockin' fans out there, that is indeed the band Jackal doing its song, The Lumberjack, and that is a chainsaw live on stage that you're hearing. So your clever and crack staff always comes up with the perfect sound.
Is that right?
Yes, that is completely...
That's a new and different twist in our popular culture.
Yeah. So here's another twist on the twist. We have Chainsaw the Musical. It's a parody, yet it's also a poignant horror show staged by our friends at Cocopelli Theater Company right here in town. It's on stage at 8 tonight, and daily through Saturday, and 6 o'clock Sunday. This happens at the Art Asylum. This crazy show, which basically tracks the hijinks of a moody man-boy trapped in a world he never made, and his trusty chainsaw, first hit the stage as a world premiere show in 2015 at the Living Room, and it's back for Halloween.
I want to interview the person who plays the chainsaw sometime next week on the show. That would be a great segment.
You're the idea man. You are the man.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 weird things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. That sounds ominous.
Ooh.
Ooh. Something's happening.
It's that time of year. Uh-oh. Well, you know, loyal followers of TV's The Walking Dead will immediately recognize that as the theme song. But
okay.
They will not be walking. The undead will be running.
Mm.
They'll be running after the runners at the Running Dead 5K.
Mm.
Gets going early in the morning this Saturday. Out at the Renaissance Festival site, it's at the rear entrance. Check-in is 9:30. The race, I should call it the race for your life, starts at 11. You can show up. You can either be a zombie, a shambling undead person, or you can be just a regular runner. And they'll have like zombie ammo that the runners can throw. These are just like powder bombs that they can hurl at the bloody, gore-infested, crusty, awful people chasing them. So it should be quite a, if you just want to like watch and not participate, have a beer, hang around at the start and finish line and weep for those who may not make it.
Okay.
Okay.
It sounds good.
Oh, it does.
Who is it?
You have an ear for good music, my
yes,
friend.
I do. Who
okay,
is it?
Okay, that's the gone, but not really gone, and certainly not forgotten, Flamin' Groovies, right?
Flamin' Groovies. I've not heard of them.
Oh, my gosh. 1960s and 70s band. Here's the story.
How did I miss this?
Well, you're not missing it, because here I am, and we're in this thing together, right? Okay, here's a paddle.
Yeah.
Start. Here we go.
Start rowing.
Okay. Old-time underground rock and rollers, if you can hear it, they have an obsession for the British invasion, okay?
Mm.
They were kind of out of step when they formed in 1965 in San Francisco because that was psychedelic city, right, in San Francisco. But as luck would have it, by the 1970s, they became a major influence on the emerging punk new wave scene. Because if you think of a lot of this early punk new wave stuff, it had this British-y sound to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the Flamin' Groovies became accidental walking gods in rock and roll history. You can see them, or what's left of them, and I dare say quite a bit, at 8 o'clock Friday night at Knuckleheads. And by the way, Steve, I caught Nick Lowe last night at Knuckleheads Garage.
Really?
Oh, my goodness.
Really?
What a fantastic show.
Sounds good.
Fantastic.
And finally today... You know, I'm glad you brought this one in.
Ha!
I've heard so many good things about this guy, Trombone Shorty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, real name, oh gosh, what's his real name? It's here somewhere, Troy Andrews, but he's better known as Trombone Shorty. He calls his mix of rock, pop, jazz, funk, and hip-hop super funk rock. Say it with me. Super funk rock.
Super funk rock.
There you go.
Yeah.
Hey, I think you outdid me on that one.
Yeah,
pal.
I might have.
Okay, definitely. 7:30, Sunday night at the Truman at the Crossroads Art and what have you district that we love to go to. He will totally entertain you. That's, you hear that glissando?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy, and the trombone was made for it. You know, I was a trombone player from 5th grade to 12th grade.
No kidding.
I was not very good, but I...
You couldn't do this?
No,
Trombone Shorty?
It's a shocker, but no, I couldn't. That's right.
That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thanks for coming in, Brian.
Oh, thanks a lot. I'll see you at Trombone Shorty, huh?
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's program, the Missouri Almanac isn't what you think, and it won't help you find a date to plant your corn. We'll take a look at this colorful way to introduce kids to our state. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produce this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.